The Daily Connect Podcast.
A very warm welcome to the Daily Connect Podcast for Monday, the 15th of October. Chris Wallace with you on the podcast today. And a great show we have in store for you as RNIB's 150th anniversary celebrations continue. We will be getting a little bit of information on Black History Month, which has once again arrived in Glasgow. The events that are running throughout the month are being told to us by Gozi Jo Adigwe, who is RNIB Scotland's Community Facilitator and Diversity Lead. She'll be with us in just a few moments. We'll also be finding out about the nominees for the Booker Prize, which is announced officially tomorrow. And we will also find out how museums can be made more accessible from our roving reporter, Roland Myers. There's also a little bit about Braille Help, its history, and how accessible technology has encouraged Braille readers through the years. So that's it for the show today. But first of all,
the Daily Connect Podcast.
As this year does mark RNIB's 150th anniversary, we're celebrating by reaching out to inspiring figures to talk about their achievements and living with sight loss. Billy Baxter is a blind motorcyclist who in 2003 broke the world record for the fastest solo blind rider. In 1997, while serving with the 1st Regiment Horse Artillery in Bosnia, Billy lost his sight after contracting a rare disease that destroyed his optic nerves. His life was never the same. Chatting now with RNIB Connect Radio's Simon Pawley, Billy tells us more about his pursuit of adrenaline and how, through the help of charities, he turned his life around.
As sight loss charity, RNIB celebrates its 150th anniversary. We are celebrating the fact that sight loss doesn't mean the end, although it may feel like it sometimes at some points along the way. Former Royal Artillery Staff Sergeant Billy Baxter lost his sight in 1997 after contracting a virus in Bosnia. Billy, who was tasked with finding evidence of war crimes, contracted the virus while he and his colleagues were exhuming a mass grave in the war-torn country. Since that time, Billy has ridden in a motorbike stunt team, appeared on Top Gear, taken a national diploma performing arts course, received the Adult Learner of the Year award, carried the Olympic torch, become the only blind town crier in the UK, completed the pace-sticking world championship, broken the world record for fastest blind motorcyclist, and is the only blind motorcyclist to have completed a lap of a GP circuit. But there was a point in between where things weren't so good. Billy Baxter joins me now. Hi, Billy.
Hello, Simon, and hello to all the listeners. May I first wish the RNIB a very happy 150-year anniversary.
Thanks, Billy. Great to chat with you. It's been a while.
It certainly has. Crikey. The years have just sort of sped by, Simon.
We're both a little older and probably a little less hair.
Yeah, I've certainly got a few more wrinkles, Simon, I must admit.
Now, taking us back to 1997, you lost your sight pretty quickly, didn't you?
Yeah, it was sort of surreal. It was like an out-of-body experience. It's I think many of our listeners will probably appreciate those that suffered any sight impairment due to illness. You sort of detached from reality, and I kept sort of ignoring it. I was losing the sight in one eye, and I thought, no, it'll get better, but it didn't, and it slowly went completely in both eyes.
But you didn't accept it, though, did you?
Absolutely not. I wouldn't accept the fact that I was blind. I didn't want to be blind. I didn't want to know anything at all about blindness or visual impairment or people to help us guys, and the trust and acceptance wasn't there, Simon.
How about with your family? How did it impact on your family life?
It devastated my family. They all think about the victim or the person with a visual impairment, but it has a knock-on effect with their partners, loved ones and children. My whole family were devastated by what happened to me, so I just went out and did everything with them, and all of a sudden I became this recluse that sat in a room, depressed and, not engaging at all.
Now, I've only ever known the bubbly Billy Baxter, and that seems like such a contrast to the Billy I know.
Absolutely. And how did I get here? Well, in a nutshell, I was just inspired by your listeners out there. And I don't mean that flippantly. I was just absolutely bowled over by learning off other visually impaired and blind people who inspired me and encouraged me and gave me support. I wouldn't listen to anybody that had sight. Why should I believe somebody with 20/20 vision that everything will be all right? I wanted to speak to the guys that have walked the walk, and that's who inspired me, your listeners.
And it's not easy to admit that you need help or even to ask for it, is it?
Especially it's a male thing, I think, is that awful word, pride, and lack of, you know, resource, or you know, not having the courage to ask for help.
I sometimes think that sight loss for men, especially if it's during life, can be very emasculating.
Very much so. You become reliant on, you know, anyone to say you can't. Simple things like a strange environment, building or area, you require some assistance in either getting to the toilet, which is really embarrassing to ask. You haven't got the flexibility or independence to move, you know, independently, you know, without mapping it out. The whole world, as we all know, becomes a different creature.
Do most of us who are living with some form of disability dip into support from charities at some point? And Blind Veterans was one that kind of turned things around for you, wasn't it?
Absolutely, Simon. Again, I was the only blind soldier in the world. I was the only blind serviceman. Nobody knew what Billy was going through. Well, little did I know that there was a charity, formerly St Dunstan's, as we know now, Blind Veterans UK. They were there to literally pick up the broken pieces and start to rebuild me again, Simon.
That's an interesting common theme, actually, when, especially losing sight later in life, there's a period where some of us just feel that we are the only person that's actually ever gone through this.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you know, just sitting there and listening to other people's stories and their journeys not only is humbling, but it's also inspirational and motivational as well. And I got to thinking, well, it's just my eyes that aren't working. I've still got youth on my side, or did have at the time. And there these people were doing amazing things, just ordinary, normal, everyday things, but they were amazing. They really were. But it was their humour, their humility, their encouragement and their energy.
I mean, I've mentioned some of the things that you have achieved, and we'll move on to that in a minute. But that's an interesting point you make, because although you've done some of these amazing feats, there's very many inspirational blind and partially sighted people today who are just bringing up a family. They are going out to work. They're just living their life. And I think there is every bit as inspirational.
More so, Simon. I talk to members, and I'm embarrassed about... Yeah, people want to know about the extraordinary things like the motorcycling and all the other things you mentioned before. But like you say, it's the ordinary things in life, the ability to bring a family, to get to the shops, to maintain a job, you know, coping with the disability on a daily basis and the other problems that the world throws at us. That is extraordinary. That really is, you know, that's amazing.
And I don't think it's a weakness to think that it is quite easy to become isolated with sight loss.
Very much so. If you haven't got a support network with you, or you might be a timid person, not so much outward going, frightened to socialise or interact with people, these can be barriers that really can constrain an individual by sort of confining them to a safe area, which is either their home or where they are, and having that ability to get out there and grab the world by the throat, you know, it takes a little bit of help and a little bit of support.
Little steps along the way.
Absolutely.
Which of the challenges that you've undertaken do you think was your biggest challenge?
For sure, my biggest challenge was in the early days of acceptance. Acceptance that I need help, you know, whether it be guiding, site guided, or support, not to try and do everything independently on my own and be stubborn. Humility, the ability to ask for help and to say, look, I'm struggling with this. And that really is a, you know, it's a bitter pill to swallow, but that acceptance is probably one of the hardest things that I've dealt with since my sight loss. And it took, and if I'm honest with you, it's probably taken me, I reckon, about 9 years, 10 years of being blind to start really embracing that.
And you also got some help from RNIB, didn't you?
Absolutely. The RNIB provide legal services regionally. And I was really struggling filling out my PIP forms and other criteria for the new legislation with the Department of Work and Pensions. Oh, where do I go? What do I do? So I contacted the Cardiff headquarters, the RNIB, who put me through to the legal service team locally, where I am here in Llandudno, in Colwyn Bay. Much to my absolute amazement, this team picked up my case. I explained to them I was struggling with forms, what to do, what to write down, how to do this. And they said, leave it with us. We'll send a caseworker around, which they did. They helped me with the forms. They then discovered that I qualify for blind person's tax credit. And a few more other things. I got back pay and all sorts, and they were absolutely fantastic. And what I'd say to listeners out there, if you are struggling with forms or legalities or just want an answer to a question, the legal teams in your areas with the RNIB provide an amazing service, and I fully recommend them.
Now, let's take the blind motorcycling record. I mean, there's no way around it. That was dangerous, even going round the lap. Was that a part of the phase of you accepting your blindness, do you think, with the fact that you still want to prove to yourself that you can do all these things you used to be able to do?
Yeah, it was a double-edged sword, really, Simon, with the motorcycling. It was a case of circumstances that just arose off the back of doing other Outward Bound things with the charity. But it was through my contacts in the army. It's something I really missed, is my motorcycling. And it was just through a chat with a mate on the phone. Next thing I know, I went down to see the motorcycle display team, and we looked at the possibilities of riding a motorbike. And that itself really started to make me believe in myself again, that, you know, people were there, that they didn't treat me as a freak, that they treated me as an equal. We did it very professionally. And along that journey, I started to really buy into trust with unknown strangers. And with the military, I really do miss being in the military. And working with them again really was helping me come to terms with my blindness.
Would you still undertake something like that if the situation arose?
Oh, crikey. The team that supported me and the land speed record, all of them now left the army. All of them I'm in contact with, and we're waiting for an Australian chap to beat my record. And then we're back on it in earnest. We're going to take another motorcycle to America, and we're going to do it again.
I thought you'd got all that out of your system.
No. It's in my blood, Simon. I can't. It's infectious. It really is. It's like a drug. It's adrenaline. It's something I really enjoy doing.
And just refresh us, what is your speed record?
Well, my official record stands at 165 miles an hour. That's the official Guinness World Record. The highest speed that we did achieve on that day was 186 miles an hour. The other side of it is Donington. We were the first people to circumnavigate Donington blind. But that was a challenge in itself as well, because it involved involved corners.
Yeah, and somebody shouting you a direction, sort of thing.
Absolutely. It was obviously done at lower speed, and the pressure was on the outriders because they had to literally second guess how far I tipped the bike into a corner or turn or speed up or slow down. So the pressure was on them building up that relationship with that magic voice in my helmet. It took a long time, to get together and choreograph what we were doing safely.
Now, you're a bit like a superhero. You're a bit like Superman. You're a superhero at some parts, but during the day, you're just like Clark Kent. You're a rehabilitation officer with blind veterans. Now, how satisfying is that?
My job and role here in our centre in Wales, we've obviously got Brighton, and we've got a Llandudno centre. So my role here is rehabilitation and training officer. So I work and mentor the newly blinded servicemen and women that join our charity. They'll come to one of our two centres for what we call an induction week. So I'll meet them at the door. Prior to that, I'll phone them up at home and explain to them that they'll be looked after during the week. I've inadvertently forgotten to tell them that I'm blind. They will come to the centre on the Sunday to be back by myself, only to hear that I'm totally blind. So that I can lead by example with them. And then I shadow them during the week, introduce them to instructors, get them orientated around the building. I sit down and talk to them. And these people are of all ages, in their 20s. Majority of our members are average age 87. And by the end of the week, they've started to realise that these charities are there to help them. It's so rewarding. It's possibly one of the best jobs in the world, really is.
So would you say that after all you have been through, the ups and the downs, that life is good?
Life is fantastic. I live here in Wales with my wife Karen. My family are all grown up. They're getting on with their lives. I've got a normal job. I come to work in the morning. I walk to work. I go home. I get moaned at because I've put muddy shoes on the floor. All the normal things. Oh, you've forgotten to put the bins out tonight. Normal life. It's brilliant. It really is.
Well, before you go, Billy, everyone's sight loss journey is unique. But would you think that there is one thing that we all have to deal with?
Yes. I think reminding ourselves of what we're doing is extraordinary. And I mean that to all your listeners now. What they're doing is extraordinary, and never stop believing in yourself. That's the secret. And get that support from people, and just, nobody's going to come to you. You've got to get out there and believe in yourself.
Billy Baxter, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you as always, and we look forward to the next chapter of, I don't know what we call, Bonkers Billy Baxter, do we?
You are more than welcome, Simon.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
Black History Month has once again arrived in Glasgow with a wider range of events on offer, including theatre, exhibitions, talks, films, tours and more. The events will be running throughout the next few weeks and explore the heritage and history of those that in the past have been forgotten. Gozi Jo Adigwe is RNIB Scotland's Community Facilitator and Diversity Lead. She joined us in the studio to tell us more about the upcoming events.
Now, the Coalition for Racial Equality and Rights, supported by Glasgow City Council, is once again pleased to present their programme of events for Black History Month 2018. Black History Month is a great opportunity to recognise the struggles and successes of black people throughout history, many of which have been ignored and hidden away. Now, how are RNIB getting involved, and how can you get involved? Well, I'm joined now by Gozi Jo Adigwe, who is a community facilitator and diversity lead with RNIB Scotland. Hi, Gozi.
Hi, Simon. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Now, set up the scene for us. It's that time again, but for those that aren't familiar, what is Black History Month?
Black History Month takes place through, generally speaking, through the month of October, but quite often it can extend into sort of December to the end of the year. It's internationally recognised as an opportunity, just like you said, Simon, to reflect and recognise some of the contributions that black people have made through the course of history, but particularly linked with some of the struggles with regards to the slave trade and to emancipation. In Scotland, it's quite unique in that Black History Month also looks to celebrate the history of South Asian, Pakistani, Indian and Chinese populations that have come to Scotland over the years.
And again, I don't think many people would deny that there's a much more rich tapestry, isn't there, in the community now with the different types of communities and customs and, I don't know, you could even say food, all sorts of things that make it much richer.
Yeah, that I think that's true. There's definitely more visibility in that respect, but it can't be forgotten that, you know, Black people have been involved in the community and society of the UK for many hundreds of years. In fact, I believe that a Black brigade of Roman soldiers were manning Hadrian's Wall many hundreds of years ago. So we have had a presence as Black people in Scotland for a number of years, but definitely within the last 20 years, we've seen a much more visible increase in Black populations, in Polish populations as well, and a greater diversity in terms of walking down our streets and the offers that are available to us.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, but you've actually got a call going out. You want some feedback from us, don't you?
Yes, I'm very keen to encourage particularly blind and partially sighted people to come along with me to a few events that are happening during Black History Month. There are a number of free events and a number of them don't require booking. There are very visual events in terms of photograph exhibitions, art gallery exhibitions, but there are a number of talks as well. I'm quite keen that we work closely with CREIR in order to expose our blind and partially sighted community to some of the programme, and then have our blind and partially sighted community feedback and what their experiences have been in terms of the accessibility of the venues, of the content and of the general experience. CREIR are very proactive in terms of being able to try and modify some of their practices and some of their events going forward if the feedback should come back that there is modification to be required for blind and partially sighted people.
And again, these are events for everybody, aren't they?
Absolutely.
So we'll give you details of how you can feedback in a little bit. Now, you were talking about the slave trade there, and I think, you know, obviously up-and-coming youngsters like myself.
Of course.
You know, we're not perhaps au fait with the history, but tell us about the slave trade and Scotland's connection with that.
Okay, well, in a nutshell, the slave trade obviously was a period of time where millions of individuals were taken from Africa to the Americas and to the Caribbean. Now, the work that they were put to there was on plantations, very often sugar and tobacco plantations. And the produce from those plantations came directly to ports in the UK, predominantly Glasgow and Liverpool and also Bristol. Now, if you walk around the city centre, places like Buchanan Street, the Gallery of Modern Art, indeed the whole of the merchant city was built on the back of the money that was made selling tobacco and sugar in Scotland. However, it has to be also mentioned that because of this exposure, there were a number of quite famous abolitionists in Scotland who eventually campaigned very strongly for the end of the slave trade. So Scotland did have quite a rich tapestry of involvement in terms of the slave trade. If you look at, for instance, the island of Jamaica, a number of plantation owners were of Scottish origin, to the extent that 30% of Jamaican surnames are Scottish as a result of that. And this would have been as a result of slave owners taking slave wives as such and having mixed-race kids, and mixed-race kids would then take on the slave owner's name. So there is a very long and lasting history. And it's one that, you know, we have to reflect on. Parts of it require just exposure and acceptance, and parts of it do require some kind of celebration, definitely in terms of the role that Scotland played in abolishing slavery.
Well, I didn't know that. So there you go. It's interesting.
You see the Jamaican flag, it's like a saltire, like the Scottish flag. That's where it came from.
See, it just takes somebody like you to point things out.
There you go.
Well, also, when it comes to sight loss and people, certain communities have a predisposition towards certain eye conditions, don't they?
They do, yes. We in RNIB have worked for many years with a number of particularly high-risk communities, high-risk because of their ethnicity. We know that within the South Asian community, particularly Pakistani community, there's up to 6 times higher prevalence of type 2 diabetes. Within the Black African community, and interestingly, it seems to be more endemic in the West African Black African community compared to the East Black African communities, there is a higher prevalence of glaucoma. What seems to be very obvious as well, and it's not anecdotal, there seems to be strong evidence to hint towards the symptoms becoming apparent and presenting themselves at a much younger age in these particular communities, and also in much more aggressive forms. So there is a different profile of sight loss within these communities compared to what we're perhaps more familiar with within the white indigenous community.
And are these communities aware of this predisposition then?
I think that if you speak to people within these communities, they will acknowledge and observe that they do have high levels of perhaps type 2 diabetes, or they will acknowledge that they have relatives who have glaucoma or who have sight loss. How they put that in context in terms with a comparison with the white community is probably where the gap is lacking. And that's something that we have to, as an organisation, to really sort of clarify and reinforce with them to ensure that they know that if there is a particular kind of sight-threatening illness in the family, then extra care has to be taken in order to ensure that, you know, for instance, your eye health entitlements are taken up regularly. Eye health checks are free in Scotland for everyone who's in receipt of NHS services. And so it's vital for particular communities to have that extra eye on the ball.
Because I suppose there could be that, the inclination to think, well, it's accepted that, you know, a lot of people lose their sight due to either glaucoma or diabetes. But the thing is, getting the message across, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way if you step in earlier and perhaps like an intervention in this and change perhaps your habits, etc.
Yeah, you know, there's a whole range of interventions that, you know, very simple interventions, and one of them absolutely is having your eyes checked regularly. The eye health check in Scotland is a full eye health check. It will detect signs of change before you notice any changes in your actual vision. And that means that, you know, specialist support and treatment can be instigated at a much earlier stage. What we're seeing too often is people coming at late stage disease where sight loss has already, you know, taken a hold. And for conditions like glaucoma and diabetic retinopathy as a result of type 2 diabetes, it's irreversible. And therefore, for people who are contracting these conditions at a young age, as I said, quite often it can be up to 10 to 15 years younger. We're talking about people who are of working age, who perhaps have young families, who are, you know, sort of maybe very involved in their communities or just much more independent. And it's quite devastating. So it is avoidable sight loss that we're talking about here.
And also it's that message that just because you don't have any symptoms doesn't mean that it's not going to affect you.
Exactly, Simon. I think we do preventative health very badly, generally speaking. We still realise that even things like breast cancer screening and bowel screening are difficult areas of health to get people to engage with. And I think that's similarly for looking after your eyes. So that's the kind of message that we're really trying to get across. It is very much the case of, don't wait until something is a problem. Just use the entitlements, use the services that are there, because they're there for a reason. They're there to ensure that you're not further down the line with significant symptoms that could have been avoided.
So you're excited about the month and, well, the next few months ahead?
I am. I was at an event last night and I'll be at one tonight. We've ticked off about three or four events that we'd quite like to go to through the course of October. As I said, a lot of the events extend into the end of the year, and they also sort of link in with other events, like, for instance, Africa in Motion, which is a festival of film that takes place between Glasgow and Edinburgh. And I think the nice thing about Black History Month of this year, predominantly it is a Glasgow festival, but it's beginning to branch out into other cities, and there's been quite a lot going on in Edinburgh this year. So if you check on the website, the Coalition for Race Equality and Rights website, they'll be able to point you in the direction of their very extensive brochure and programme of events.
And for feedback after attending these events, how do we get in touch with you, Gozie?
Okay, well, you can email me directly, Gozie Jo Adigwe. I'll spell that out for you. gozie.joeadigwe@rnib.org.uk. Alternatively, if you are blind or partially sighted and you haven't joined our RNIB Connect Facebook page, you can also post something on our RNIB Facebook page, which is a closed page, which we community facilitators as admin will be more than happy to take your requests to join the page.
Well, it looks like it's an exciting and interesting time coming up, using the lessons of the past to build a better future for all of us. Gozie Jo Adigwe, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Simon. The Daily Connect
podcast. At the Booker Prize shortlist party, Kwame Anthony Appiah tells Red Sail about this year's shortlist and how hard the judging process has been in preparation for the official announcement of the Booker Prize winner tomorrow.
First awarded in 1969, the Man Booker is recognised as the leading prize for literary fiction written in the English language. It's open to writers of any nationality, for novels written in English and published in the UK. The list of former winners includes many of the leading writers of the last five decades, from Iris Murdoch to Salman Rushdie, Ian McEwan to Hilary Mantel. This year's shortlist of six novels was announced by the chair of judges, Kwame Anthony Appiah, on a blustery evening in the grounds of the Serpentine Gallery in London's Hyde Park, and I caught up with him moments before he went on stage. Anthony, welcome to Read On.
I'm very glad to be with you.
So, was it a difficult process this year, judging to choose the final six for the shortlist?
It's always difficult, I think, because there's usually an awful lot of very good books, and this year is absolutely no exception. And getting down to 13 was difficult to make the long list, and really hard getting from 13 to 6, because I think all the 13 on the long list were terrific. But it's a very congenial group of people. We work well together. We've been reading together now for, you know, since early in the year, meeting once a month. And so, guided by each other, really, we came to a final six, which represent the judgment, the collective judgment of us all. So none of us would have chosen exactly the six if you just left it to us on our own. So it's definitely it's the jury's list. And we're all very happy with it. We all like every book on it. We like a lot of books that aren't on it too.
Were there any that all the judges chose? Obviously, you can't tell me which, but or were there a wide cross-section of books that everybody had as a favourite?
That sort of isn't how the conversations go, so you don't say, this is my book and I'm going to, stand behind it until you trample me into the ground. So I don't think of any of the books on the final list, really, as belonging to anybody in particular on the group. I suppose if you ask them, each of the judges might be able to say that they liked some more than others now. But honestly, we were talking to each other this morning, and we all agree that we don't know who's going to win. I mean, we and not just because we can't predict what the other people will do. We haven't, any of us, made up our minds ourselves. These books survive an amazing test, which is that we read them once. If they get onto the long list, we read them again. And if they get on the short list, we read them again. Not many novels survive being reread with careful attention three times in a row. Many people read a novel for a second time, but they don't usually do it within 6 months or a month. So we learned a lot on the second reading, and I'm sure we'll learn more on the third reading.
Many of our listeners have to access their books as audiobooks. Were any of the judges tempted to listen to the books as audiobooks rather than read them in print?
I don't think anybody did that. Nobody mentioned doing that. I certainly read them all in print. I should say that on the long list was at least one book that would be difficult for someone who was blind or visually impaired, because it was mostly images. It was a graphic novel. And that one of the novels on the short list, The Long Take, has photographs, mostly of Los Angeles in the early 20th century, which are quite an important part of the book, and those obviously will be difficult for visually impaired people, but it's a poem, so there's lots and lots of words in it too. So actually the one that would have been hardest for your listeners would have been the graphic novel, Sabrina, just because it's mostly images, there's some words in it. But otherwise, I think I can say that at least one of the novels on the shortlist is a novel that I would like to hear myself, because it's in the voice of a character whose voice is very important to the novel. And in a way, at least one of the novels, I think, will work at least as well, if not better, as an audiobook, because the voice of the narrator is so important to what the book is about. So there may be on the final six, there may be at least one that blind and visually impaired people will actually appreciate more than sighted people.
Well, we are very much looking forward to listening to the shortlist and our Braille readers to reading them in Braille, which is a fantastic thing that the Booker Foundation does for us. And Anthony, thank you very much for being a guest on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's been great. Thank you very much.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
We all have the right to visit museums and get a real sense of the history provided. But what are museums doing to make things accessible for blind and partially sighted people? Roland Myers has been finding out more.
Recent research shows that a major barrier to disabled people visiting museums is the lack of advance information about what the museum can offer. And this is often, but not always, searched online. Museum websites are key tools for providing visitor access information, and the research carried out by, amongst others, audio describers Vocalize suggests the absence of this means people with a disability are less likely to be regular or frequent visitors to museums than those who are not disabled. A publication called The State of Museum Access 2018 offers guidance to help museums create or review the information that they provide online. And with this, a Museum Access Pledge has been launched. This outlines common aims that all museums of all shapes and sizes should try to achieve to make themselves accessible and welcoming to everyone. As well as its live performance audio description work, Vocalize works with museums to help them to improve how they make what's on display accessible, maybe through a large print or braille guide, maybe an audio descriptive guide, maybe a one-to-one personal guide to accompany someone around an exhibition or gallery. We spoke to Matthew Koch, Chief Executive of Vocalize, about the State of Museum Access 2018 report and what it says.
We've learned from talking to lots of people from surveys that have been done that a vast majority of people visiting museums, and particularly disabled people, people with visual impairments and other disabilities, pre-plan visits to museums. They don't just drop in. They will regularly look online to find information. and specifically access information to see if the visit is worth it for them. Firstly, to find out how to get there. And then secondly, are the objects and the exhibits accessible to them? Is there, for example, a large print guide or a braille guide, or are there audio-described tours? So all those things. And many, many museums have very little access information. And we've also found that the majority of museums that have access information, it's normally limited to access information about mobility and about, you know, whether they're lifts or ramps. So specifically for wheelchair users and people with mobility impairments.
So are you finding that this contrasts perhaps with a growing tendency for museums, if one can generalise, to actually make their exhibits and their exhibitions more accessible to a blind or partially sighted person? They're just not able to get the information out there to say it's here and this is how we can help you around the exhibition.
That's a very good point. I think there are more and more museums providing access for blind and partially sighted people at museums, but it's still a very small number. And there's probably also a number that are doing things, but they're not advertising it. And I think our report is a call for both. It's for both museums to shout about what they do and make sure that people know about it, but also for those museums that aren't doing anything to consider doing it. And particularly the first two things I mentioned there, which is large print guides and braille guides. I mean, large print guides can be used by a large number of partially sighted people who would really benefit. And they're not expensive to make. If you have a printer and some paper, it's very straightforward to make. But still, only a small proportion of museums advertise those on their website.
And have you been able to communicate this to the museums? And I ask that kind of expecting the answer, do you not realise just how disparate all these museums are? Because presumably there's no simple way of actually getting in touch with them all, is there?
For the moment, since we've launched, we've been getting in touch with all the ones that we've mentioned for positive reasons. We included links to about 100 museum websites saying these are the ones to go to because they're really good. So far, we've been in touch with all the museums that we wanted to pat on the back. I think our next job is, yes, to get in touch with the museums that don't provide information, point them to our report and the guidelines to help them improve. We are also planning on going to talk at conferences where museum people go and other means as well. But yes, I think our next job is to get this report so that they read it, take some action.
And there's been quite a lot of talk, I mean, you've mentioned it yourself, about providing information online. Of course, for some blind and partially sighted people, the internet is still a no-go area for them, simply maybe because they haven't had the training or access technology hasn't sort of been part of their lives up until now, perhaps more elderly people in particular. Are you urging, and does your look at the situation say that really this kind of information should also be available, for instance, at the end of a phone?
Absolutely. No, you're right. And we make a big thing in the report that this type of information shouldn't only be put on the website. It needs to be known by the staff at the front desk, the staff who answer email inquiries or answer phone inquiries. Absolutely, definitely. Because there's no point having an access resource if the staff in the museum don't know of its existence and don't know where it is. And that kind of information has to be ready available however you contact the museum. And also those inquiries need to be answered promptly, because you may email or call the day before you go to a museum and you shouldn't have to expect to wait, you know, a week or 2 weeks to get a reply about it. You need that straight away. So yes, absolutely. It's something we make a big point on in our report. And also about being open for inquiries by email or by telephone, and providing contact information and encouraging people to contact you to ask questions that you may not have answered on your website.
And your research, your work has revealed specifics where things are not as they should be. And out of that, I believe, you've created your Museum Access Pledge that you want museums to sign up to. What does that pledge say? What are the things it covers?
Okay, yeah. Because our report covered a vast range of museums, from the large national museums in kind of large cities like the V&A, the Tate, the British Museum, down to very small local volunteer-run museums in rural areas, you know, the whole kind of range of museums. We're aware that there's a vast difference in the capacity they have, what they can do in terms of the staff they have and the budgets they have. So it's really about an attitude change, and that's what our pledge is. We're kind of saying that information is key, and providing good, honest, detailed information doesn't cost anything. So the pledge is asking museums to kind of be proactive in addressing barriers to access and encouraging people with disabilities to visit the museum rather than seeming just to see them as an issue or a problem to deal with. And also putting the information that you provide in a kind of welcoming and warm tone, as opposed to in a very kind of legal statement that often can happen at museums. And encouraging potential visitors to get in touch, and also after the visit to give feedback if they've got any suggestions for making it better.
And I guess that brings us full circle, really, back to what part the visitor has to play in this. Because you talked about, and we discussed, you know, making a phone call to say, I'm coming to your town tomorrow. You've got a museum there. Can I get in? And what can you show me? And is it accessible? So is there a big part for people to play to actually kind of make this all happen more quickly if the phone is ringing and museums are hearing blind and partially sighted people saying, I want to come and visit?
Yes, exactly. I mean, it may be that you want to visit a museum and you don't see anything online. That doesn't mean the museum knows you visited their website and looking for that information. But if you phone them up and say, I'm interested in visiting, do you have large print? Do you have Braille? Do you have audio descriptive guides? And make that call and make them aware that you're interested. And if they don't have it, they've lost a visitor. I think that's a great idea.
And if you'd like to find out more about the guidance given in the State of Museum Access 2018 report and the Museum Access Pledge, or perhaps get up-to-date information about museum and gallery exhibitions, which Vocalise publishes in their newsletter, you can phone them on 020-7375-1043. That's 020-7375-1043, or you can email enquiries at vocalise, spelt vocalise.co.uk.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
Continuing our 150th anniversary celebrations now, we are finding out about Braille. And it's estimated that less than 8% of visually impaired people in the UK can actually read Braille. However, with advancing technology and changes to the outdated Braille readers, there is talk about a potential rise in literacy levels. James Bowden, RNIB's Braille Technical Officer, tells us more about what the future of Braille could have in store for us, as well as discussing the Orbit 20 refreshable Braille display.
Today we are talking about Braille. It's been around for nearly 200 years now, created by Louis Braille to help blind people learn to read, to write, learn all about punctuation, in fact, improve reading skills and literacy across the board. But in the 21st century, how relevant is Braille with all the new technology now? And indeed, how easy is it to learn whatever your age? Well, to answer some of these questions, we have with us from RNIB, James Bowden, who is the man to talk to about Braille. Is that right, James?
Apparently my job title is Braille Technical Officer, yeah.
So I've got the right person, which is always a good start. So to Braille has been around for quite a while now. Let's just explain to people a little bit about the basics of Braille, because there's different formats. Does it come in different languages? Is it easy to learn?
Yeah, all of the above. So Braille is based on characters made up of up to 6 dots. So if you imagine an egg box, a standard egg box, put the short side towards you, and then you've got 2 columns of 3 dots. So 1, 2, 3 down the left and 4, 5, 6 down the right. And I think it's absolutely amazing that such a simple system as that can do letters of the alphabet, numbers, punctuation, different languages, mathematics, science. You've even got Braille music.
What about learning Braille? Is it something that's easy to do? Does it depend on your age, your finger sensitivity?
Yeah, it depends what you want to do with Braille, because the basics of Braille, learning just the alphabet, you can do that in an afternoon. But if you want to go the whole hog and learn all the what we call contractions, I'll come on to that in just a moment, that takes a bit longer. When I learned Braille, I was, I think, 6 or 7, and I think it probably took the better part of a year. The key, though, is not just being able to learn the code. You've also got to teach your fingers to go over the dots and maybe even write Braille. So there's almost three key skills to learn: the dots themselves, reading it, and writing it.
So you would learn the alphabet first. You learn that with Braille, but there are contractions that you call them. So is that creating groups of letters or words in a simple form?
Yeah, that's right. It's a bit like a cross between shorthand and texting, except Braille got there over 100 years before the mobile phone was invented. So we have, in English contracted Braille, signs for common letters, combinations such as TH, ST, ING, SH, ED, etc. And then common words such as the, and, with, so, every, and so on and so forth.
So once you've learned the basics and move on to contracted, is that grade one to grade two?
They are sometimes called grade one and grade two. Grade one is writing everything letter for letter, like you do in print. And grade two, or contracted Braille, uses the extra signs for common letters and common letter combinations. Braille can be used for simple things, such as just labelling tins in your cupboard, right the way through to, shall we say, practical things like post bills, right the way through to more pleasurable things like reading novels and unpleasurable things like exam papers.
Okay, so we've got the Braille there. Do you need then a certain sensitivity in your fingers, or is that something with practice that you would pick up easily?
Yeah, I think practice is definitely a key. So the very first Braille shapes that we recommend learning are the simple ones, such as the letter A. Here we go, first Braille lesson, even on air. The letter A is just a single dot in the top left, so that's fairly straightforward to feel. And the letter L is three dots in a vertical line down the left. So we start with just those two, and they're quite easily to say, that's a bigger one, that's a smaller one. Oh yes, I can begin to feel that's different. And then the third letter might be, for example, the letter G, which is a little square. Two dots in the top row, two dots in the middle row, makes a little square. And again, you begin to say, oh yeah, that's a nice big square shape. You may not necessarily, when you start, feel every single individual dot, but the more you practice, the easier it gets. It's like lots of things.
Okay. Now, we are, as I said, in the 21st century, and there's always a debate, Braille and technology. Now, I'm guessing that you're going to fall down on the side of Braille, but with a touch of technology?
So it's no longer the case that Braille has to be written on very bulky books, shelves and shelves of ancient tomes, which you think, my goodness, who's going to read that? No. Nowadays, all the paper stuff still exists, of course, but you can get electronic Braille devices which attach to, say, a computer. I've got one in front of me here, and it's showing the time at the moment on the end of it. It's focused on the system tray at the bottom of my computer screen. So this gives me the benefit of both speech and Braille, both together. So I usually say speech for speed, Braille for precision. Let me give you an example. I was proofreading a document a while back, and right the way through the document, it was talking about Section 7. Now, with the speech, it all seemed absolutely fine. When I read it with the Braille, I noticed that it was saying Section and then the digit 7 for all but one occurrence when it wrote out S-E-V-E-N. Now, they sound exactly the same in speech. They're very different in Braille, and it is a proofing error. So I was able to do a very accurate proofing job with the Braille. Another example would be, you're in a noisy environment. Speech isn't that easy to hear. So using the Braille again, brilliant. What about a lovely example that a friend of mine uses? He's blind, and he says he has a sighted child. He likes to read a bedtime story to his sighted child. So what he does is he gets his iPhone, connects it to his Braille display, and then he reads the Braille, and the child follows along on the screen of the iPhone. I think that's brilliant.
Absolutely, totally agree with that as well. And I imagine then that Braille is incredibly important to learn because you're building your literacy skills. You know, you mentioned spelling there, punctuation. You're not going to get that from just listening to a book or a piece of text.
That's absolutely right. And I have seen some absolutely atrocious spelling from people who I would possibly say evidently only use speech and don't use a spell check. Braille will help you greatly with that sort of thing. I think they say that spelling is a visual thing, and even though Braille strictly isn't visual, it's still actually orthography, and so you will actually learn the spelling and so on and so forth.
We still see Braille, James, you know, on lifts and sometimes in restaurants people can be offered Braille menus. So it is still there, although we are in the 21st century. And also something which many sighted people will probably pick up as well, maybe seeing products in supermarkets or pharmaceuticals with Braille.
Absolutely. And this is a huge benefit to those who read Braille. All pharmaceutical packaging now in the UK, I think it might even be an EU directive, has to have Braille on the packaging. That's really, really helpful, especially if you've got two different medications and you've got to take three tablets of one kind and one tablet of the other kind, and they're in the same size box. Vital that you get them the right way around. And the Braille really helps that kind of thing. I think it's the Co-op have also put Braille on their own brand products. Again, really great, really great.
Absolutely. Some more progress there. Let's come right up to date, though, at James, and talk about the Orbit Reader 20.
Yes. So RNIB launched the Orbit Reader 20 Braille display, which you can use to read books, take notes, connect to your mobile devices or your computers. It has 20 Braille cells, a standard Braille writing keyboard, and the really exciting thing about the Orbit Reader 20 is the price. It's a fraction of the cost of traditional Braille displays.
You're going to frighten me with some figures here, because I know they are traditionally very expensive.
They are, yes. We're talking four figures.
So the Orbit not only is brand new, it's more affordable now.
That's right. The list price is $449. Excluding VAT, but RNIB Connect members can get a special discount of $399.
So you're saving almost £50 there if you're a Connect member on an already very affordable Braille reader. Have you had a play with it yourself?
I was involved in the testing, reporting to the development team. I actually sorted out 220 volumes of Braille to put on the device. So if you buy the Orbit Reader 20 from the RNIB, you get a selection of books for children, adults. There's some classics, there's some new titles, about 30 in total. We've even included a dictionary on there, and you can use the Orbit Reader to search through the dictionary instead of having 38 Braille volumes on your shelf.
Sounds great. A huge sigh of relief for many people, I think.
That's true,
James.
It's 38 volumes. Yeah.
Wow. We're almost out of time, James. If people would like to learn more about Braille, maybe getting started learning or the tech solutions as well, what's the best place to go to?
So on our website, we have a page all about Braille. It's rnib.org.uk/Braille. There is a link there to learning Braille. We offer a number of self-study courses, or you might be able to get a Braille class in your own area. Call our helpline on 0303 123 9999, and they can give you all the details. And we also offer a free alphabet card, which shows the Braille alphabet and a few other common signs. It's just one sheet of paper with actual embossed Braille on it and the print equivalent.
Great stuff. So you can have a little bit of a taster as well. Furthermore, then, to James Bowden, thanks for speaking with us on RNIB Connect Radio.
Pleasure.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
And that's it for Monday's Daily Connect podcast. We will be back with you with a brand new podcast just after 5 p.m. on Tuesday. So if you're subscribed, make sure that your podcast provider gets that podcast to you. If you are not currently a subscriber, you can always go to our Audioboom channel, audioboom.com/RNIB Connect Radio/podcasts, to get some great features from every show on the station. Thanks for joining me on the podcast today. Have an excellent time, and I'll see you again.
The Daily Connect Podcast.